This is GamesAtWork.biz with Michael Martin and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 202. Everything old is new again. Hello, this is Michael Martin joining you live, well, recorded live, for yet another edition of GamesAtWork.biz. I'm so sorry I missed the last one with our erstwhile co-host Andy, but I'm delighted to be back again with my current, former, future, and I don't know, all-time number one co-host, Michael Rowe. Hey, Michael.
Hello. The once and future co-host.
Yes, exactly.
So which one of us is Merlin?
I don't know. Do you have a sword or I don't know.
I have a pointed stick.
There you go. We've got some really cool things to talk about here on this pre-July 4th. We're glad that the U.S. is its own country and not part of the Commonwealth celebration week.
And also, just a big shout out to all our Canadian listeners who are about to celebrate Canada Day, right?
Absolutely. Oh, Canada, indeed. So we're right on that verge. We're taking a short break out of our watching of the World Cup, although that's getting to some really exciting stages now, too, to talk about technology. And we're going to start with, and we actually had to listen to the pronunciation of this one to make sure we got it kind of right, daguerreotypes, old photos that are old that are being made new again. And you're like, Michael, we've got to talk about this.
Oh, cool. I thought we were doing that later, but let's do that one first.
Oh, wait. Did we? Yeah, we decided to do that later. Dang.
But that's okay. We can talk about it now. So, I saw this one a couple of days ago come across the feeds. And this was just really amazing to me. I know we've you and I both have dealt with photography and pictures.
Nudge,
wink, winks. I know I'll say them all. I've actually been converting a bunch of physical photos into digital photos to, keep in my various digital libraries so that I can search on them and, do things with them, et cetera. And just converting, I've found like pictures of a little baby me, right? That have discolored over time. And, part of it almost looks black and white, other part is really nice color because it was hidden underneath the edge of a frame or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about, how do you recover the picture? And then I saw this article. And this article actually is a group of researchers who have figured out how to take these old daguerreotypes.
Yeah.
Yes, which were the old magnesium silver plated or iodized silver plated plates that were used to take pictures in the early days of photography. Yeah.
Where they had to hold you so steady,
right?
That many of these pictures, they actually had a neck brace to keep your head from moving around while they were exposing those plates.
Yeah. I mean, really cool. And mm-hmm. I've seen some of these, and the resolution and quality of the pictures,
it's pretty good.
Are really good.
Yeah.
But what they've done is they've uncovered these plates or these photos that have broken down and are basically, like a big slab of gray or almost blackish gray. And it's like, how could they recover the pictures from it? They actually have a video attached so you can watch how it works. But actually using a way of uncovering the mercury in the picture in order to rebuild the image that was underneath it.
Yeah.
And I just thought this, as a tech podcast, this is some really cool tech, right? And they're basically using this what's called rapid scanning micro X-ray fluorescence imaging on the plate for like 8 hours to slowly get back the image. And I'm reading a book, as you know, on Leonardo da Vinci.
Mm-hmm.
In that book, they talk about how scientists have used different techniques to uncover the different layers of the paintings that he did to see, because most of his works are unfinished because he was never finished with them. He kept tweaking and building and tweaking and modifying and adjusting.
Iterating.
And so using these various different techniques from technology perspective, they are able to, you know, kind of go back through the archaeology, if you want to consider it that, of the layers of the painting and discover, you know, how did he actually lay out the perspectives? Because there's multiple perspectives in his famous Last Supper, as an example, right?
Yes.
And so these kind of just all fit together as just really interesting ways that new technology is able to go back and rediscover some of the art and just beauty of things made with really old technology.
Have you seen The Last Supper in person?
Not in person. Have you?
Yes.
Cool.
I was in Milan a long time ago.
Were you hungry?
And not so much. I mean, Milan is full of great food, but and there is a restaurant there called Bocca Divino, which I'll put the show note link in there. If you're ever in Milan, you need to go to this restaurant. It is super awesome. But no, the Last Supper, there's so many interesting stories around it. But the one that really struck me is that it didn't get struck by the bombings that happened in World War II. It was miraculously preserved with bombs falling all around and nearby and the buildings crumbling, but the wall that it's on survived.
Wow.
So lots of amazing stories around that painting and that, like where the lemon appears, where it was on the plate and it wasn't on the plate and then it was on the plate and it wasn't on the plate. So but I know exactly what you're talking about there, Michael. Super, super cool kinds of stuff. And incidentally, speaking of Canada, like we did before, this whole story came about as a result of some work being done in the Western University in Canada, too, which is pretty cool.
Yes. And
yeah, exactly. All right. So let's go back.
And a daguerreotype is named after a Frenchman. And they speak French in Canada. Which has,
oh, okay. I thought we're going back to and France helped the United States win the Revolutionary War, because that's not. Been thinking
it's
about
all
that today,
interconnected. It's the Illuminati, because they're illuminating the picture.
It's all there. It was there from the beginning. So let's do go back to the future and go to where we intended to start, but I goofed it up because I looked at the wrong spot.
But it was cool, because that was a cool discussion.
It was cool. It was really a nice place to go to begin. We have from our good friends over at MIT up in Boston, an interesting article about AI. And in this case, linking topics that we love. We love games. We love artificial intelligence. We love all kinds of stuff. And in this case, the two come together in an augmenty kind of way. So you want to talk about Dota, which neither one of us has played, or should we focus on the AI instead?
No, let's start with Dota, because I'm a huge Blizzard fan, and I actually have many of the different Warcraft games, as well as World of Warcraft. And Dota was an outcropping of one of the early Warcraft games, I think Warcraft version 3. And
it was a mod, right?
Yeah, it was a mod to that that became an open source thing and turned into kind of a team-based Warcraft battle, which is Defense of the Ancients or something like that, if I remember what we looked up earlier.
We have to look it up, yeah.
but what was – so there were a couple of things that were cool about this article to me. One, the major clickbaitiness of the MIT article title.
Oh, sure.
AI algorithm work together to crush humans in complex video game. And then you read it, and it's like, well, what really happened is they were able to use Dota to make a Dota team, all AI characters, that could eventually consistently beat an average player.
Right.
Right. So that's not crushing humans, right? Maybe eventually, because, you know, this stuff goes exponentially pretty quickly. But clickbait headline that I clicked on.
Yeah, well, the picture of Team Human was, you know, pretty fun too, right?
Yes. They didn't look very crushed, though.
No, they're looking almost, well, they were intent.
They were serenely looking at their screens going, click, 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 click.
Right. But the interesting thing is that, yes, they were AIs, right? Artificial intelligences, but they had to act together as a team because each member of the team has certain strengths and weaknesses that all have to play off of one another in order to succeed.
Yes. And that's where it goes back to our fun and scary things of things like kill decision.
Yep.
Where you get into swarming behavior. But swarming behavior is all about very simple algorithms that together do a complex task. This is many different AI characters, right, with different personalities working together to defeat a group of humans, also playing different characters.
Exactly.
So that's much more interesting, and it actually makes me want to go and try to fire up a Dota game.
Well, it makes me want to understand the inner communications amongst the members of the team, because one of the things that AIs will have over any human competitor is the ability to share information faster than people can with one another. So even if, just for argument's sake, Michael, you and I are both expert Dota players and we are exceptionally well attuned to one another. Like, you always play this character class. I always play this character class. I know how you behave. I know what you're going to do. Right. So I know that all instinctively because we played together as a team and we have three other members that we feel the same way about. That level of expertise, that might be a little bit hard to match at an AI level. However, the ability for the AIs, though, the five member team that are all artificial intelligence, can communicate with one another so fast that they should be able to act, react, and orchestrate themselves as a unit faster than any human team could. You know?
Yeah. And what I'm wondering is, because at least in this example of the game, the human players are all physically in the same room.
Yeah.
Granted, they have headsets on and microphones, so they can probably talk to each other that way. But if they were facing each other, would a glance, a facial expression, be as effective performance and speed-wise as the AI messaging that occurred to do a communication of a specific task?
Maybe. My argument is whatever the communication is between the AIs, it is inherently at light speed. So even a glance...
Well, it's at electrical speed.
Yeah, electrons. Yeah.
They're not, you know, light. What I mean. They're not doing photons. Right. They're doing electrons.
Right. But the equivalent, it's that fast, right? Your only latency is going to be with the metal in between the computers. If they're not all on the same server somewhere, potentially.
Yeah, so. You know, this is interesting. I remember reading a book, and we've talked about it on the show a couple of times, On Intelligence by Jeff Hawken, the guy from the graffiti language for the Trio and Palm Pilot. And this might play into the thought process here. And he was talking about how the human body could catch itself from stepping incorrectly off a step.
Right.
And faster than you would think possible, because the speed of a signal of a misstep at the foot going through the nervous system is actually a set of chemical and electrical transactions going up to the brain that then have to send again
back down.
back down to the foot to, you know, adjust balance, blah, blah, blah. And so that's slower than the speed of light. And therefore, when you see somebody catch themselves almost instantaneously, it doesn't make sense. And when you take that exact same logic and put it in a robot, the robots fall over because they're going off of a purely electrical signal. And again, it's not fast enough. And so the way that the problem is resolved is, what does the brain actually do? Well, the human body and brain is a exception processing-based prediction engine, which says when my foot extends to this place, it should touch the ground or touch the step, and I can predict that, you know, I've hit a step based off of learned behavior, and therefore when I miss a step, it's not miss a step, react, do something, and then do something. It's the prediction, as soon as it fails, has already triggered the next event to behave correctly. And so from an AI perspective, we take that same logic, and most AI, as we've learned, as it's done now, is prediction and confidence intervals, right? So the system learns based off of historical data and infers connections between that data in order to predict predict an outcome when certain events are triggered.
Right.
And so the whole concept of a neural network or a machine-learned algorithm for this game would be understanding the behavior of the players, both my enemy combatant players as well as my partner players, and there's not necessarily any communications required because it's based off of predictive modeling.
Interesting thought, Michael.
I come up with them every once in a while.
Yeah, I know.
I think that's how it can get so much faster, right? It's just predictive models.
Mm-hmm. And this is where something like this becomes much more intriguing than let's go play chess or let's go play Go. It really requires multiple entities, AIs or people, working in tandem.
And that's interesting. Right? So compare the model between Go and Dota.
Yep.
In Go, the moves are simple, but there's, you know,
the strategies are complex.
The strategies are complex, but the moves are simple and the board is finite, even though it's a very large number of possible moves, right?
Yep.
Dota, the board is actually much more complex.
Maybe not infinite, but it's big. Yeah.
Just think about it.
Terrain, all kinds of stuff.
I don't know the exact number of dots on a Go board, but let's say there's 100 dots on a Go board. And each dot has, what, four lines or something like that?
Sure.
I don't know the game, but let's pretend that's it, right? And the game world of Dota, let's say it is, you know, 20 by 20 tiles in the game world. And in each tile, you could fit 50 battle units of whatever they are, right? That's already exponentially bigger than a Go board.
Right. And if we know Blizzard's experience that they've created along the way, there's a lot more than 20.
Yeah. Yeah. And so now you think about it from that perspective, just the complexity of 1v1 in a Dota world would be, I'm guessing, more complex than Go, because each character could do, let's say each character has three different moves, right? A near fight, a distance fight, and a defense.
Yep.
Right? So anyway, I just see the permutations of this drive you to think of many, many different models. And that's why the predictive model with an exception processing would be much more effective than trying to predict all the moves, right?
Right.
Like you do in a chess or a Go model.
So linking that to the augmentation concept, if you have an AI helper to help you as a player, one of the five on a team, there's another level of communication or abstraction to say, okay, AI, you take over these mundane tasks and I'll do these strategic things. You know, I'll control the movement of my character. You optimize whether you do ranged attack, distant, near attack, or defense movement.
Yeah, and then spawn off another sense of yourself, AI, and do all my resource gathering to build my tech tree.
Right.
Right.
Right. Optimize
that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very cool. Other than that, there's the communication too between the AI and the human to make those choices. So it becomes a level of what do I relinquish control over and say, you do this on my behalf as a cooperative AI, or you give me insight on what I should do at various points based on what I know, because according at least to the article, again, I'm not a Dota player either. A great amount of the game deals with unknowns and unexpected conditions throughout the game space. Yep. So you have to have that predictive model and know and begin to statistically choose what it is that you want to do. All right, so we've kind of delved deeply into a game that neither one of us has played, but it's an interesting thought experiment, nevertheless, as we think about how AI can help people do what they need to do. Our next story deals with people helping one another, and this one turned up in my feed because here you are in summertime, and there are people always going on various trips and everything. And from this Telegraph article, there's a notion of an eBay for travel. So this particular service is called Transfer Travel, and it stemmed as a result of a person feeling like, okay, I can't make this trip that I've booked for whatever reason. I have all these non-refundable fees, and if I were only able to find someone to take over my reservations and deposit, maybe they can pay me most of my money back, some of my money back, and then they can go and have a trip on the cheap. And it struck me as, wow, this is pretty good, because there's always been an insurance market that you could say, hey, if I've gotten sick, you could buy travel insurance and that will refund you all the non-refundable things. But of course, you pay money for that insurance, right? And you have to be able to prove it out. Yep. But this allows for a segmentation that, gosh, I guess it's a lot like how you might work with tickets for a sporting event or a music show or something like that, that those tickets
are... You become your own scalper.
Yeah, you become your own scalper, right? I mean, you could be standing outside the venue, and moments before the production starts, your ticket's worth, you know, almost face value or much higher than face value. And after it starts, it diminishes. So wouldn't it be interesting here that if I had a 2-week vacation on the Canary Islands or something, and we're now in a week into it, and no one's bought my reservation off of me, but we're a week into it, and there could be like a super steeply discount thing, last minute travel that finds this, maybe an AI, Michael, nudge, that says, hey, you don't care where you go, you just want someplace warm and has good drinks, and you go get a cheap flight too. How about this? Wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah, you know, before the show, when you brought this one up, I mentally kind of poo-pooed it because to me it was just a way of letting somebody else deal with the scalping problem for you and then making a 15% transaction fee off of it. But you do bring up a good point on the value of it over time and the ability that, you know, once the vacation started and you couldn't go, you kind of just throw your hands up in the air and you're done, right? And you say, screw it, I blew it, right? I've just wasted, in this guy's case, you know, £3,000 worth of hotel booking fees. But the ability to, you know, make it worthwhile would be good. And I think, you know, any way that you can make yourself a little bit more whole when unexpected events come up. And then, as you say, leverage maybe an AI to go out and find it for you. I think this is a good idea. I do. I have come around.
You've come around. You're no longer poo-pooing it. You're just pooing it.
No, I probably would never use it. But I get it now. And I think it's a valuable service for others. I tend to be very particular, and I like to do things in advance, and I'm not very often going to do a very expensive vacation at the last minute, even if it's highly discounted.
You know, I just went on the site just to kind of poke around for a moment, And it is much more common, at least in Europe, from my experience, to have an all-inclusive vacation, yep. right? Everything is packaged up, your flight, your hotel, everything, right?
Yep.
So I just went on just for giggles and I said, show me what vacations I can go get. And the vacations I can go get, there's several of them. Some of them are looking rather, you know, really nice. But there's 18 of them. So it's not, you know, like a ton mm-hmm. For me to go and buy. So maybe at the moment, this is much more of an offload structure versus a non-offload structure.
Yeah.
So
yeah, no, but maybe it'll kick in and it'll take off and it'll become valuable for others.
Exactly. So hopefully so. So just like going on vacation is kind of borrowing an experience and having it somewhere else, we know that the art of transportation is evolving pretty significantly. And we've talked on this show already several times about subscription-based transportation services, I guess kind of like an airline ticket. Well, Volvo has now announced something that works very much the same way, where you don't buy a car from your app on your phone, but you subscribe to a car from yes. an app on your phone. And I think this is the first one, at least the first one I've come across, where you are getting the opportunity to subscribe to an S60 Polestar sedan. So it's a four-door sedan, high performance, et cetera, et cetera. And the only way to get this particular model car is through your app on your phone. Is this the first one you've seen?
It is. This is what's really interesting about this is, you know, the auto industry for years has been dealing with the changing demographic of drivers and the fact that people just consider it transportation now, right? And many of younger generations, I'll say that, right? Mm-hmm. Older generation wants to own their car. The younger generation just wants to get from point A to point B, and they don't even really care to even learn how to drive, right? And so that's really changing the buying behavior and the dynamic of the relationship of the auto industry with their customers. And so one of the key things is, how do you get brand loyalty when people don't buy the thing anymore? And so, you know, Mercedes does this with their Car2Go process to get people to leverage car rental, you know, short-term car rental, kind of like a Zipcar type thing, but with Mercedes to build up loyalty. So once you move out of the inner city of, you know, your first job out of your college, and you're living in downtown New York and you don't need a car and you don't really care to, right. Okay, now you got a family and kids and you got to live out in suburbia and you need the minivan. Well, if you had this great Car2Go experience, you'll then buy a Mercedes, is the basic premise.
Sure.
Volvo's approach of, okay, we realize everything's going to be a subscription. Nobody wants to own anything. Well, we're going to switch it and put you at the top of the line, right? So the Polestar, I understand, is kind of their equivalent to an M-Class or an AMG.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to put you at the top and let you experience the best that we have to offer from Volvo as a subscription model. And that's a really interesting approach. I think this is kind of cool. We'll see how it rolls out, because, you know, they're saying you got to do it through the app, and there's a limited number.
Right. They only have 20 of them.
There's a limited number. I can't tell if it's models or total number of cars, right?
Yeah. So I this is a way of creating urgency. This is a way of creating uniqueness. And I think those are good things for, you know, some star quality for their cars and for launching this Polestar brand the way I see it. I mean, I've known about other Volvo higher performance vehicles, but nothing like AMG or M or anything like that that the German brands have had. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see if this is successful first, because this may be the way to go. Zipcar and other ride sharing services allow you from an app to say, I'd like to rent that car right next to me right now. That'd be great. And yeah. Maybe that's going to be okay here too. But this feels to me like it is not a renting of the car. It is a subscribing.
It's subscribing
so you have it. It's yours.
Yeah, the latest car. And they do make it clear later on in the article, it's only 20 of these cars will be available. So right. The first 20 people who fired up the app yesterday, from the day we recorded, could order it for $1,100. I assume that's per month.
Or it could be per day, too. I don't
plus
know.
Plus taxes, registration fees, gas, and electricity.
Yeah. So, interesting. Would you subscribe to a car at this point?
No, I don't even subscribe to Apple Music.
Yeah, well, I mean, for us, cars are very personal things. They're an expression of self, their freedom, their ability to move and go and do. And I suspect for a lot of people around the planet that they're a conveyance. And yeah.
Well,
you know what?
And that's the fear that the car industry has, right? That is the changing behavior. But speaking of loving your old car, right?
Oh.
And as you know, I am still driving my old car because they won't make a new model with my color. this is interesting. Maybe I ought to go for this. So tell us about this article that you found.
Yeah, I will. So this particular article I saw on CNN, which was talking about how Prince Harry had been driving himself and his bride away from the evening wedding reception in a classic Jaguar, I guess that's what I said, E-Type. You know, one of those just form and function kind of cars that is just absolutely, you know, gorgeous, gorgeous. And this car had been converted to full-on electric. So all the exterior components of the car, the wheels, the mirrors, etc., look classic, but the internal drivetrain, battery, etc., are all electric. And this is a bit of a new thing of taking old things and making them new again with newer technology. So there are trends out there, and we've seen this for a while. I mean, the Volkswagen Beetle is a great example. The BMW Mini Cooper is another example. So there have been domestic examples here too, PT Cruiser, all these sort of things of having kind of older style designs with newer technology and up-to-date technology in them. But the article is really focused in about electric retrofitting of vehicles in order to preserve those classic body lines and the time of the car with the new capabilities. So I could see where this could be really nice.
Yeah. Wonder what it would take to upgrade mine.
Probably a lot. You know, based on what they've been saying here, you know, these are not cheap to go do that sort of thing for a vehicle. It could be an awful lot of money.
An awful lot?
Awful lot of money.
How about less than? How about equivalent to buying a new car?
Yeah, well, there could be that too.
I would be okay with that because I like my car.
Well, I mean, but there's other things that have to be dealt with, right? I mean, yeah. Suspension have to be dealt with, water seals around the doors and sunroof. I mean, there's a variety of things that bringing a car up to speed and keeping it maintained properly, you certainly can do that for. I think, you know, now 20-year-old cars that are still running around on the road, they're pretty good. They're pretty solid.
Yeah.
So could do. All right. Well, look, that brings us to the end of our show for now. So we're hoping that you've got some ideas about what you'd like to do with your vehicles, whether you might subscribe to a car or some other type of mobility service, what you're thinking about the artificial intelligence structures and how you might be able to use bots and AIs to help you with your day-to-day tasks. And if you have any of those thoughts or ideas and things you would like us to talk about, Michael, what should you do?
Well, they should tweet them at us this week. This week, I want you to go to Twitter and go to @gamesatwork_biz and throw us a show note idea or something to talk about in 2 weeks, because next week, I think you're out on holiday and I'm going to be out of pocket during a normal recording time. So we will be back in 2 weeks with our upcoming episode number 202.
Well, this will be up 202, won't it?
This is 201. No, you're right. This is 202. Our upcoming episode 203. See, I'm not used to counting this high.
Yep. There you go. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. Glad you were with us and on board for this show. And we'll look forward to seeing you back on the next one. Talk to y'all later.
See ya.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network. And we'd like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.